Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Ted Zayin Amud Bet, two lines from the bottom. Tanu Rabbanan, Ketzad Merakdim Lifnei Hakala. How does one dance before the Kala? Over here, we're speaking about the mitzvah of being Mesameach Chatan VeKala. In all likelihood, the mitzvah is really focused on the Chatan and not the Kala. It might relate to the nature of the mitzvah over here. And more in likelihood, the mitzvah is incumbent upon the Chatan in terms of Kiddushin and Nisuin, and therefore the directive here to be Misameach is more likely towards the Chatan than the Kala. Then why is the focus here on Ketzad Merakdim Lifnei Hakala might be to be Misameach the Chatan, that the response that we see here is not that we are dancing before the Kala, but is the way that one relates to the Kala. And in relating to the Kala, one can be Misameach the Chatan. That's what the response of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel here refers to, is how do we address the Kala, or how do we speak about the Kala in order to endear her in the eyes of her husband. Beit Shammai umrim, Kala k'mot shehi. You tell it like it is. You say what the Kala is. We're not going to lie. We're not going to make up things. We tell it exactly the way it is. Now, as Tosafot points out over here, that we don't focus on negativities. We don't focus on things that aren't so nice. But rather, we talk about those qualities that the individual has that are positive and things that will be pleasing. Beit Hillel omrim, on the other hand, Kala na'ah v'chasuda. We say about the bride that she is pleasant and pleasing. You know, that we give a general statement about the positive nature of the Kala. And in a sense, we're going to see from the response of Beit Shammai, it basically means that we say about the Kala that she is beautiful and that she is wonderful. Beit Shammai responds and says, V'amar lehen Beit Shammai le Beit Hillel, Harei she'hayta chigeret osuma. If the woman in some way has some sort of physical impairment, and that may in some people's eyes not be so pretty or so beautiful, Amrin Allah, you're still going to say, Kala na'a v'chasuda. You're still going to say about this Kala that she is beautiful and pleasing. It's very clear here from the statement of Beit Shammai in his response to Beit Hillel that we're not talking about the midot of the woman. We're not talking about the spiritual side of the woman, but rather we're talking about the physical beauty of the woman. And over here you're trying to speak to the Chatan and give him some sort of pleasure at the fact that he's chosen such a beautiful Kala. So Beit Hillel says that's exactly what you tell him. You've gotten a beautiful Kala. Look how pretty she is. Look how wonderful she is. Beit Shammai says, how can you do that? That's just not the truth. You can't tell a lie. And how do you tell a lie here about this Kala? So you have to tell the truth. You have to say what it is. And as Tosfot points out, you talk about other features that she has that are beautiful. She has beautiful hands. She has a beautiful face. You focus on the positives, you know, as many people do when it comes to shiduchim. You ask them one question, they respond with a different answer and talk about a different quality. Obviously implied in that is that the answer to the question that you're asking may not be exactly on the positive side. So they focus on other positive elements of the individual. And the same thing over here, that you focus on those things or those qualities that are beautiful. Now, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel argue here in a similar vein or nature that they argue in other places in Shas, where Beit Shammai looks at the essence of the individual, what they really are, whereas Beit Hillel deals with the practicality and the realities of what is in front of us at this point in time. And therefore, we have this machloket by Nerot Chanukah that we've seen before, where Beit Shammai says we look at the potential. And therefore, when we come to the first day, we light all 8 candles, looking at the essence and the potential of what's there. Whereas Beit Hillel is much more focused on the reality. What day is it? And therefore, we only light the number of days that have transpired or passed since we began Hanukkah. And the same thing over here. The Kala and the beauty of the Kala is a very subjective manner. And the fact that this individual has chosen this Kala is obviously because she is beautiful to him. And therefore, we compliment the Kala. Whether you feel that way or whether you have a different opinion about the Kala is not so important. What's important here is that this woman to this man is beautiful. And so therefore you have to be Mishabeach, you have to praise her. And the potential that this woman has to bring tremendous Simchat or Chatan, then we're going to focus on that and not on the negativity and not on what you personally feel about the kala. On the other hand, Beit Shammai says that honesty is chotamato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, emet is the way of Hashem, and therefore we want to focus on being truthful and, yes, praising the kala, and yes, making the chatan feel that he got a great kala, but doing it in a way that avoids any semblance of a sheker. In truth, it's a perspective on life, and it's different ways that people deal with life. Because some people talk about the truth and are very frank and honest, and therefore people are appreciative of their opinions because they know they're getting the honest opinion. And other people are much more mannered or nuanced in their approach to things, and therefore they are pleasant to listen to and always positive and optimistic in the way that they describe things, despite the fact that even though they may be aware that there are problems or issues over here. So that is a balance or approach to life. One is being emet, chotamo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a sense din, just direct and honest about certain things. But human beings are frail. Human beings are emotional beings, and therefore they sometimes need a little bit of a softer approach, which is what Beit Hillel promotes over here. And it's a difference that we know between Shammai and Hillel in their actions towards others and other opinions that we find from them in Shas. Tamilhem Beit Hillel, the Beit Shammai, the Divrechem. According to your explanation of what we say to the Kala over here, Mishal Akach Mekach Ra Min Hashuk, someone who purchases something that isn't of the best quality from the Shuk, Yishabchenu Be'enav, should he praise what the individual bought? O Yiganenu Be'enav, or should he denigrate it in his eyes? Havi Omer, I say, Yishabchenu Be'enav, that you should praise it to him. Because over here you have an individual who purchased something. He might have buyer's remorse over here. He may not be so secure in what he did. And in the truth, it may have been a little bit of a mistake. But you don't want the person to have those uneasy and terrible feelings about what they did. And therefore you say to him, wow, look at that wonderful thing you bought. Look at that new item that you got. In order to make the person feel better about their purchase, about what they did. You could tell them the truth. And that's what Beit Shammai suggests, that you tell them the truth about it. But that type of stark reality and truth sometimes is so difficult for the person to swallow or to handle. Therefore, we don't want to do that. And that's what Beit Hillel says. Sometimes it's better just to make the person feel good about their situation, because, as we say over here, Mikan Amru Chachamim, Lom Te Dato Shel Adam, Me'urevet Im Abriot. A person should always be pleasant to be with, a person who is positive and makes other people feel good about themselves, because that is a primary quality that we're looking for in individuals, that they make other people feel special and they make other people feel good about what they do. Now, the Rishonim point out over here that if someone is coming for an expert opinion to an individual, that one should be honest about that. We're not talking about an expert over here. We're not talking about someone coming for advice in this situation where telling them the truth is much more helpful than covering up the truth. But even when you do tell them the truth, it might be good to do it in a nuanced manner. But over here we're talking about after the fact, when someone's already made a decision, whenever someone has moved forward, whether you agree or disagree with that isn't as important as making the person feel good about what they did. And then you can work on whether they need to be straightened out or things need to be corrected after the fact. Kiata Rav Dimi, Amar Hachi Mashru Kamei Kalata B'Marova. This is what they used to sing before the brides in Eretz Yisrael. Lakechal, Vela Serak, Vela Pikus, Yalat Chain. She doesn't need makeup. Lakechal means that she doesn't need eye makeup. Vela Serak, she doesn't need blush. Vela Pikus. And Rashi over here explains that's the braiding of the hair. Tosafot in other places in Shas disagrees with Rashi, says it's another form of makeup, maybe mousse in the hair. Yalat Chain, and yet she still is pleasing and pleasant. The compliment in the Marova was that she's just a natural beauty. She doesn't need any makeup. She doesn't need any additions or trappings to make her beautiful because she's such a natural beauty. Similar to the concept that was raised here by Beit Hillel and the idea of praising the Kala and making the Chatan feel that he got somebody very special and a beautiful bride. Yisamchu Rabbonon the Rabbi Zeira. When Rabbi Zeira received smicha, Sharulei Hachi, they sang this similar pidgam that they sang to the brides. They sang to Rabbi Zeira at a smicha, Lakechal v'lo sarak v'lo pirkus v'yalet chayin. Again, it's an idea of the beauty of this individual, the specialness of this individual, that he's reached the point of smicha, that he doesn't need, again, outside trappings, but the persona or the person themselves is special, and that's why they're getting smicha over here. Yisamchu Rabbonon the Rabbi Ami or the Rabbi Asi. When Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi were granted the smicha, Sharuluhu Hochi, they sang this. Komindain v'komindain smochu lanu. Like this and like this, pointing to Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, we should have many more of these individuals that are musmachim, that receive smicha. V'lo tismechu lanu. And don't give smicha lo minha sarmisim, v'lo minha sarmitim. The Rashi over here says that these sarmisim are people who are misarseis halachot, behefech tameim, people that mix up or twist up the halacha, and it comes from the word sir sus, which, again, many of the other Rishonim also explain in a similar vein, which is people who do not know the halacha, who get mixed up with the halacha. And then Rashi over here says, v'lo sarmitim, from the word smartut, and not rags, people who are not worthy of receiving smicha. V'amri lo, and some say, lo mina chamisin, not from the chamisim. Some give explanations here, chamisin means from chamishit, as Rashi quotes over here, one-fifth, which is someone who only knows one-fifth of the knowledge that is necessary for smicha, or one-fifth of the mesechta. That is the sheet of the Aruch. Rashi and Sanhedrin brings down an alternate pshat, which is that they shouldn't be from those chamsanim, shemunim melomar tamei Torah. Those are a chamas that steal or take away and don't give the proper explanations of the Torah, or don't allow people to reach the true understanding of Torah. V'lo min ha-tormusim, and not from the tormusim. Rashi says, lo yitparesh, over here, what the explanation of that is. Others explain that the girsa is tumusin, and Rashi says that tumusim are anshei chamas. These are people that are still thieves, people that are not pleasant to be around, or because it happens to be the tormusim season in Eretz Yisrael, which is, it's the lupine season, lupine, which is very bitter. That's what they're saying here. V'lo mina tumusim, those individuals who are very bitter. So they were complimenting Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi at reaching the point of smicha, saying that these individuals are so appropriate for the smicha, and we should have more and more like them, and not mean from those peoples that get smicha that are not appropriate and are not on the level of Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi. It's interesting here that the Gemara parallels the smicha of the Rabbonon to the celebration of a kala. And the same way that we compliment the kala in front of the chatan, so too do we compliment the rabbanim that are coming to smicha. Of course, if it's appropriate, we compliment them. I'm coming to smicha, I assume, before the am, before the people, so that the people also realize that they're getting somebody special or somebody unique who is going to be an authority figure over the am at this point in time. Rabbi Abba, ki avi atu mimitivta lebei kesar. Rabbi Abba, when he used to travel from the yeshiva to the Beit Kesar, Rabbi Abba seemingly lives in Kesaria near the seat of the Roman government and had good relations or was an official within the government of the Kesar. So he had free reign to go from the yeshiva, which he had in Kesaria or somewhere near Kesaria, into the palace or the government buildings in Kesaria. So when he used to travel or walk that way, Nafkan Amhata de Beit Kesar, the maidservants of the Beit Kesar used to come out to greet him. Umashin Lehachi, and they used to sing or greet him with this phrase, Rabba Dame, a leader or great one amongst his people, Umidabrana de Umte, and someone who brings or leads his flock, Botzina de Nehora, a candle that gives off light. Rashi over here relates it to the appearance that he had a radiating face, something that was extremely beautiful. Brich matiach l'shalom. Baruch bo'acha l'shalom. Blessed be your coming, that it should be in peace. Others have a slightly different version of this, which is Baruch mevi'echa l'shalom. blessed be the one who brought you l'shalom, meaning that it's referencing HaKadosh Baruch Hu rather than Rabbi Boam himself. But here, again, you see a certain amount of respect and compliment being paid to Rabbi Abo, given his authority and his leadership. And here the Amhatot are making B'nai Israel realize, or the people of Israel realize, that they have someone very special here, a leader who is very special, and therefore they're praising him so that they acknowledge or understand the greatness of their leader. Amru alav al Rabbi Yehuda bar Ilai, notel bad shel hadas. He used to take a branch of myrtle. Umirakeid lifnei hakala, and he used to dance before the kala in order to entertain her as well as compliment the kala. Like we said before, Kate said, Miraktim lifnei hakala. Vomer, and he used to say, like the Shita Beit Hillel, kala na vechasuda. He used to compliment and say positive things about the kala in front of the chatan to endear the kala to the chatan. Rav Shmuel bar Rav Yitzchak, Mirakeid atlat. He used to dance with three. Now, even the context of the Gemara over here, the Tlat seems to reference the Hadassim that were mentioned here, that he used to dance with three Badei Shel Hadas. He used to dance with three branches of the myrtle. Rashi over here brings down the possibility that he was juggling. Mekareda Tlat means he had three items, and he was juggling those three items. Amar Rabbi Zera, Kamifsaf Lan Sabo. The elder one is embarrassing us, meaning that according to his position and his stature, Rav Shmuel bar Yitzchak shouldn't have acted in this way. It was beneath his dignity to do this. And it was an indignation to his post and to his stature to act this way before the Kala. Kinach nafshei, when Rav Shmuel bar Yitzchak passed away, ifsig amuda denura ben didei lukulei alma, a pillar of fire came between him and the rest of the am, v'gmiri, and we have a misora. This pillar of fire only comes down for one in a generation or two in a generation, meaning that it's a significant compliment to the individual about the greatness of the individual. Amar Rabbi Zera, so Rabbi Zera himself, who had before said that it was an indignity the way he acted, Ahanyalei Shitutei Lesabo. So the Shitutei Rashi translates over here as being the Hadas. The Shut Shel Hadas, Shemer Akedbo, helped out the elderly one. The Amri Law, some say Shtute Lesabo, some say the Shtut, the way that he acted and he was wild in front of the Kala, helped out the elderly one. The Amri Law, Shitate Lesabo, that his Derech, the way that he conducted himself, helped out the elderly one. Meaning Rabbi Zera came to the realization that even though it had been beneath his dignity to act this way, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu rewarded him for acting in such a manner, and it was appropriate what he did. He was a tremendous anav, and he realized that if a person of his position and stature, first of all, would come before the kala and do these things, it would mean so much to the chatan and kala, but even more so, his compliments and the way they acted towards the kala would mean so much to the chatan that it would endear the kala to the chatan. And therefore, he was willing to be mochel on his kabod in order to do that. And he's rewarded by HaKadosh Baruch Hu giving this siman about how unique and special this individual was, because he cared so much about other people and how other people felt, that he's willing to be mochel on his kavod in order to accomplish that. Rav Acha markiv la katvei umirakeid. Rav Acha used to take the kala up onto his shoulders and dance around with her. Imagine that. Amalei Rabbanan anan mahu lemevad hachi. The younger whippersnappers look at their Rebbe doing this, and they say, Rebbe, can we do this also? So, Amar the Hu says back to them, Idamyan alaychu kishura l'chaye. If the kala to you is like a board, then go ahead. Gzunta hate. You can do it as much as you want. Ilo, lo. But if you see a kala and not a board of wood, then you shouldn't do it. So, basically, he was saying that this was not for everyone to do. This wasn't for the masses. This was someone like him, of his stature and ability, who was not affected by the fact that he was carrying around a kala, a woman on his shoulders. So he said, for me, it's okay. For you, in all likelihood, it's probably not a good choice for you to do something like this. Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonatan, mutar leistakel bifnei kala kol shiva, kedei lechavava al bala. One can look and peer, gaze at the face of the kala for all 7 days, because in doing so, it will cause the chatan to be impressed by the fact that other people are looking at the beauty of the kala, and it will make him feel more special about his kala. So we waive what is normally a restriction against looking at women or gazing at women, because over here there's a positive side to this, which is that it causes the chatan to be excited about his kala. The Gemara concludes, that the halacha is not like this, meaning that the risk is too high. That even though there's something positive associated with this, which is it will cause the chatan to be excited about his kala, on the other hand, the risk of men gazing at women brings with it too high a price, and therefore the Gemara rejects this, even though underlying it is a beautiful idea and concept. Nevertheless, the Rabbanan realized that it wasn't probably the best way in order to accomplish this mitzvah. Tanu Rabbanan, Mavirim ha-meit lifnei ha-kala. We remove the meit from in front of the kala, v'zeh v'zeh lifnei melech Yisrael, and both of them from before the king of Israel. So over here you have a hierarchy, seemingly in the Gemara over here, which is if you have halvayata meit, people accompanying a meit to be the burial, and you have people accompanying the kala to her chupa, and you have a choice now, which one gets deferred because of the other. Over here it's clear that mavirim et ha-meit lifnei ha-kala, that the entourage that is together with the mate should take the alternate route, or should go beforehand so that they do not interrupt the entourage that is with the kala. We give precedence to the kala over the mate. And again, both of these are tremendous mitzvot of chesed, hachnasat kala uvayata mate, things that do not have a shi'ur. But over here, the Gemara is clear about which one gets priority, which is the kala over the mate. And one likelihood is because one of them is a chesed for the chayim, those that are alive, versus the chesed for the mate. Yes, we know that the chesed of a mate is a chesed shalmet, which is the ultimate type of chesed. On the other hand, it's also important to know that doing chesed with people who are alive has so much more of an impact on those individuals, and actually is much harder for many people to do, which is to contribute and do chesed with those that are living. And over here, the Gemara gives clear precedence to the kala over the mate. Some, like the Ramban, see this as a general principle, which is that any time it comes to a question of the mate versus the kala, we will give precedence to the kala over the mate. So if it comes to expenditures or it comes to public funds, all of these items, we will always give precedence to the kala over the mate. On the other hand, the Rambam seems to disagree with that type of hierarchy and says that it's a unique din to this circumstance over here. Now, both of them get deferred because of the king of Israel, and that is because the king of Israel has a necessity that the people view him and the position of the monarchy as being something that is unique and special, that it cannot be deferred for any reason, because then the authority of the king is embedded in the individual's hearts, as well as the fear of the king is still there. If, for whatever reason, the king would excuse himself and allow others to walk over him, then it would cause, in some ways, a diminishment of the seat of the monarchy, or the king would have to do something to offset it in order to reinstate the proper fear of the monarchy and individuals, and we don't want that. So therefore, when it comes for Melech Yisrael, we say that the kala and mate are deferred because of the kavod of the Melech. Amru lav Agrippas Samelech, they say about Agrippas Samelech, shavar lifnei kala, that he actually deferred in front of a kala. V'shabhu ha-chachamim. The chachamim praised him for doing such a thing. Shabhu michlal d'shapir avad. Wait a minute, they praised him because that means that he must have been doing something good. V'amar Rabbi Ashi afilu man damar nasi shemachala kvodo, kvodo machul. Even according to the one who says that when it comes to a leader like the nasi, he has the ability to be mochel, to forgive his kavod, and let people either address him in a certain way or act towards him in a certain way, as long as he grants them that ability. Melech shemachal al kvodo, ain't kvodo machul. When it comes to a king cannot relent on the necessity for kavod, or a certain amount of reverence that is towards the king. Damamar, because the pasuk says, som tasim alecha melech, that you have to place upon you a king, shetei emato alecha, that his fear will be upon you. Som tasim means that every action that is taken has to be done in a way that the people understand the authority and the position of the monarchy. The bottom line is that the king is not the monarchy or the seat of the monarchy. The king is just the representative of that position of authority or that leadership role within Klal Yisrael. And therefore, he doesn't have the right to be mochel, because that would mean that he was being mochel on a personal level. But his authority or his position is not because of who he is as a personal level. It's because that is the institution of Klal Yisrael. And he doesn't have the right to do that to the institution. And therefore, the institution itself demands kavod and demands a certain amount of reverence towards the institution, which he doesn't have the right to be mochel on. On the other hand, we find by Talmidei Chachamim that a Talmid Chacham can be mochel on kavodo. And the Gemara says that's because Torato, the Torah that he has, is his Torah. It's his personally. He's acquired it. He has an acquisition on the Torah. And therefore, he's allowed to be mochel on his kavod because it's something that came from him personally and something that he developed himself. And therefore, he has the right to be mochel on kavod. Whereas Melech Yisrael, who represents the monarchy and not just himself, therefore doesn't have the right to be mochel on kavodo. So over here, how was Agrippa Samelech deferring his kavod to the kala? The story is actually told in the Yerushalmi. It's a very nice idea, which is that Agrippa Samelech says that I wear the crown every day. This kala only gets one day of her life to be a queen. So I should defer. I can walk the other way. I can step out and let her enjoy her day as the queen, because I always will be the king. Anyway, it's a very beautiful concept, a beautiful idea that Agrippas did. But was he right in doing so? Because he then was mochel on the kavod of the monarchy, which he wasn't entitled to do. Now, the Rishonim point out over here, Tosafot, we saw this in Tosafot and Yevamot as well. He speaks about Agrippas the Melech, that it wasn't so clear that Agrippas the Melech was considered to be a Melech Israel, and that the Chachamim are criticized for looking the other way by the fact that Agrippas the Melech was the king. First of all, there are many questions about whether he was even Jewish at all. And number two is, he was a Roman vassal. So him having a status of a Melech Yisrael is somewhat questionable over here. Even though the Gemara is treating him like a Melech Yisrael, they, Chachamim, viewed him as a quasi-monarch or a continuation of the Malchut Yisrael. And therefore, they treat him like a Melech Yisrael, or demanded of him to act like a Melech Yisrael, even though in reality he may not have been a Melech Yisrael. So the Gemara says, over here, it wasn't such a problem. Parshat Drachim Havai. There was a fork in the road, meaning that he had a choice to make which way to go. If he went one way, it would interfere with the procession of the Kala. If he went the other way, it wouldn't interfere with her. So at that fork in the road, he could make a decision without it looking like he was Mochel HaKvodo, even though he really was supposed to go straight and go bump into the entourage of the Kala, and that would have caused a problem for the Kala. He made a choice to go left instead of right. And in doing so, it wasn't obvious to the onlookers that he was Mochel HaKvodo. But anybody who knew about him and heard him make the decision realized it was because of the Kala. But it's not obvious to the outsiders, and therefore it wasn't really a Michilat Kavod or a denigration of the position of the monarch, because he made a decision from the outside that looked like he was just needed to go this way instead of that way. Tanrabanan, Mevatlim, Talmud Torah, Lotzata Meit, Ulachnasat Kala. We are Mevatel Talmud Torah. We stop learning Torah. We empty out the Yeshivot in order to do Lotzata Meit, in order to accompany the Meit, and accompany the Kala. So now, Tosafot over here points out that Lotzata Meit is lo b'meit mitzvah. We're not just dealing with a case where it's a meit mitzvah. Elo b'chol meitim. Here we're dealing with any meit. And therefore, it's not a unique din in meit mitzvah. Even though in talking about the hierarchy in the Gemara Megillah, the Gemara over there talks about meit mitzvah takes precedence over Talmud Torah. But Tosafot says over here, it's not unique to make mitzvah. This is true of any meitim. And therefore, when the Gemara talks about make mitzvah over there, the reason it uses make mitzvah is because of the other relationships that are mentioned over here. But the relationship Torah is not unique to a make mitzvah. It's true of any meitim. Tosafot also makes a distinction, which is very important halachically, that there's a difference here between hotzata meit, accompanying the meit out, versus taking care of the meit and the needs of the meit. And that is that as long as there are people attending to the meit, then not everybody has to be mevatel from their work or mevatel from Talmud Torah in order to attend to the needs of the meit. On the other hand, when it comes to hotzata meit, that is not true. So even though there may be groups of individuals or a chevra kadisha that deals with the meit, therefore the people of the city do not have to stop working, they do not have to be mevatel from Talmud Torah for that individual because his needs are being met. On the other hand, when it comes to hotzata meit, that's what we're speaking about here. That trumps everything, and therefore, even if it's been taken care of by other people. Here the individuals have to be mevatel Talmud Torah or be mevatel from their malacha in order to do what Sata made. We'll see up to how much or how many people are needed in this case. And the same is true for Hanasat Kala. Amru alava Rabbi Huda b'Rabbi Eli, sheya mevatel Talmud Torah utzata meit on Hanasat Kala. So we know that Rabbi Huda b'Rabbi Eli did exactly this. This was his practice. We saw before that he used to dance before the Kala. And over here again, we see him giving tremendous kavod, both to the mate and to the kalot. When is this true? Shani mo kol tzarcho. That is, if he doesn't have sufficient accompaniment, or the entourage is not big enough yet. Vieshimo kol tzarcho, ein mevatlin. But if it's a case where he has a sufficient entourage, ein mevatlin. Over there, we're not mevatel Talmud Torah. So the Gemara asks the obvious question, v'kama kol tzarcho. What is sufficient accompaniment, or what is for the kavod hamet enough in terms of atzat hamet? So Amar Rav Shmuel Barini Mishmei Derav Tresar Alfe Gavre B'shit Alfe Shipure. Once you've reached 12,000 people that are accompanying the mate, and 6,000 Shipure Shofarot, or people that announce about the mate and publicize the issue, so 18,000 people. V'amri Lo, and some say Tresar Alfe Gavre, that it's really 12,000 people, Uminayu Shita Alfe Shipure, that amongst them you have 6,000 people who are either blowing shofarot or announcing about the Avelut that is taking place. Ula Amar, Giron, the Chaitse Gavre, Me'avula Abad Sichra, that if we have enough people that go from the point of the gate of the city until the kever, until the burial plot, which we're usually outside of the city, the cemetery is outside of the city, so you have a line that reaches from the gates of the city out to the cemetery, then that's sufficient already. The loss of the life of the individual is the equivalent of when it was given. But over here, given means at Har Sinai. Just like the Torah was given with 600,000 individuals, so too, when the person goes back to Shemaim, and that's the end of his learning of Torah, and in a sense, it's the return of the neshama to Hashem. That points the same way. There'd be 600,000 individuals would be sufficient at that time. At that time, meaning that it's a number that is very rarely reached in terms of 600,000. Now, this idea or this concept that connects between the giving of the Torah and then the loss of an individual, or in a sense, the comparison of a Torah to an individual, plays a role in other places, and we see that, for instance, with regards to standing up. When a Torah is in motion, one has to stand up. When a Talmud Chacham is in motion, one has to stand up as well. And we see this comparison between an individual and the Sefer Torah. And it's obviously related to the amount of Torah that this person carries around, or the amount of Torah that this person is asukba and teaches. And that's what the Gemara here is going to differentiate. Vahani mile tekari vitoni. That is true of someone who learned Mikra, learned Tanakh, and Tani, and learned Mishnah. But he did not service Talmidei Chachamim, or he wasn't as familiar with the Gemara. So 600,000 is good enough for someone who's Kari Tani. Oleman d'matne let le shiura. On the other hand, for someone who taught others, or someone who engaged in the Gemara, then there is no limit for those individuals. So we see from this that there is different levels of kavod that are appropriate for the individuals. We have a machlokin amongst the Amoraim, what is considered to be sufficient or kol tzarcho over here. And they also differentiate, even within the kavod that's given here, depending on the level or the type of Talmud Chacham that we're speaking about here. Difference between those that learned, those that taught, what they learned. There are different gradations of kavod that is necessary for those individuals. There are two things that are clear from here, which is number one, the Gemara only asks about a limit with regards to Hotzata Meit. But when it comes to the Hotzata Kala, there, the Gemara gives no limit. And from that, many of the Rishonim conclude that when it comes to Hotzat HaKala versus Havayat HaMeit, there is no limitation, and there is never a number that is sufficient by Hotzat HaKala. That's number one. Number two is the Shiltot, who is quoted here both by Rashi and the Tosafot, says, Umimela Shmainan. From this we can conclude, the Mandalo Kari Velotani, someone who didn't learn Torah and didn't learn Mishnah, then we do not worry about increasing the level of the Havayat HaMeit, as long as there are sufficient people to deal with the burial of this person. So as long as there's a minyan for these individuals, that's sufficient in order to give them the proper kavod, and we wouldn't be mevatlin Talmud Torah for those individuals. So we're here, that's a very limiting factor, that it really, this idea of halivayat ha-meit is really limited to people who are leaders of the community, people who are osek b'Torah, and people who are teaching Torah. That's where we have this unlimited number or these large numbers. But when we're talking about seemingly regular individuals, then there may not be as much of a compelling reason to be mevatel Talmud Torah in those instances, as long as the tzarfei ha-meit are taken care of. And that means that the havayat ha-meit over here may not be for kavod for the meit themselves, but more about speaking about kavod ha-Torah and kavod ha-Shem. And therefore, people who are kshirim, people that are leaders of their communities, people who have tremendous good midot and learn Torah, the kavod and the respect that's paid to them is not just the respect for the meit, but it's an understanding or paying respect to the way the individual conducted themselves and what they saw as important in their lifetime. And therefore, giving kavod to the meit is actually giving kavod to Hashem. And in those instances, there is no limit, or we say that mevatlin Talmud Torah for that. On the other hand, when it comes to simply kavod ha-meit, over there, kavod ha-meit means that he's taken care of. And therefore, the tzorch ha-meit, if you have a minion, you have those that can take care of the meit, that is sufficient. So when we're dealing with an ideal that is greater than the individual themselves, then there may be no limit to the number of people that have to be involved in havayat ha-meit. But when we're talking about the kavod ha-meit, literally, the meit themselves, then what is sufficient there is the individuals who can take care of the meit in that instance. Now we go back to the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, im yesh edim she'atzta b'hinuma. If we have edim that she went out with the hinuma, then we know for sure that she was a bitula. The Gemara asks the obvious question is, my hinuma. What is a hinuma? So the Mishnayot in general are speaking in language of Eretz Yisrael, in the language of Hebrew. Many times the Gemara will ask the question, here is a terminology that was used in Hebrew or in the Mishnaic language, and the Gemara wants a translation of it into their lifetime, meaning whether it's into Aramaic or into the practices that they have in front of them. How does this hinuma relate to that? So sarchav bar papa shmei ziri amar, tanura da'asa. It is like an oven made out of myrtle. As Rashi explains over here, that's like a min chupa shel hadas agula. It's like a circular or arched myrtle chupa that was brought around the kala. So it was something that was decorative, that was made around the kala. Obviously this was only done for kalot that were bitulot, and that's why it's relevant that they didn't come and say this, because if she was an almana or bi'ula, they would not have done this tanura de'asa. Rabbi Yochanan amar, krita diminamna ba kalata. It is a veil by which the kala can doze off. It's a veil that comes over the eyes of the kala, and therefore if the kala dozes off, you're unable to tell that she's dozing off because she has a veil over her face. So here the Gemara translates the hinuma as a veil rather than a chupa or some sort of canopy or adornment of myrtle that is around the kala. But again, the veil was a sign only for those that were bitulot and not those that were bi'ulot. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka Omer. So we have additional items that are brought in the Mishnah indicating that this was a wedding of a bitula. The Gemara over here says, Tana bi'Yehuda. The Mishnah is talking about the practices in Yehuda. But, bibavel, raya bibavel mai. What are the indicators in Bavel as to a bitula? What are the practices here in Bavel? So, amarav, darduge de mishcha aresha de rabonon. It is the placing of this aromatic oil on the heads of the young Talmidei Chachamim. They used to put oil on the young Talmidei Chachamim, or the heads of the young Talmidei Chachamim. Whether it means that was a sign of kavod, or it was like going to the spa on that day, but it was an expression that indicated that this woman was a bitula, and therefore people were happier, and there was more involved, and therefore putting this shemen, or passing around the shemen that they used to put in their hair, was considered to be a sign of a bitula. Amalei Rav Papa le'Abaye, mishcha dechafifuta kamar mar. So he said, Rav Papa doesn't understand, he says to Abaye, this shampoo, basically, that they're putting in their hair, that's what the siman is of a bitula. It's clear here that Rapapa was not aware of this practice, and therefore this practice in Bavel is not as widespread as we thought. I mean, it's not all of Bavel practiced this way, because Rapapa is clearly not aware of this. So Amar Le Yatma lo avdalach imeich darduge mishka resha derabonon b'shat maaseh. He says, you're as if you're an orphan, that your mother didn't do this at your wedding. How are you not familiar with this practice? Your mother didn't do this for you at your wedding. Now, Abaye's statement to Rav Papa is interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, Abaye is an orphan, and Rav Papa is not an orphan. But as we saw in the Gemara in Yevamot, Abaye gets upset at Rav Papa, and because of that, Rav Papa becomes an orphan. And I don't know if that's what Abaye is referencing over here. You, now, you're going to be like a yatom, like me. Me, who I didn't have parents, so maybe I shouldn't be aware of this. But Rav Papa, you have parents. How is it possible that you're not aware of this practice? But in the end, we know that the practice wasn't as obviously widespread as the Gemara indicates over here, and that's why Rav Papa seemingly is not aware of this practice. Kihahu midrabonon. And now the Gemara brings evidence of the fact that this was the practice. The asagle the brei. We saw this expression before. He asagle the brei means that he worked on a shidduch for his son, Bei Rabba Bar Ula, and that he was trying to marry off his son to one of the daughters of Rabba Bar Ula. Ramila Rabba Bar Ula, he asagle the brei. Or on the other hand, Rabba Bar Ula was working on behalf of his son in order to marry him off. Bei Haumi Rabbonon, in the houses of one of the other Talmidei Chachamim. Bedargig Mishka Reisha Derabbonon Mishat Maaseh. And at the time when they agreed and then the marriage was going to go through, then they put oil, or this aromatic oil, in celebration in the heads of the Rabbanan. So the equivalent today, you know, when a baby is born, people pass around a cigar. This was the equivalent in that time, meaning that once there was a betulah that was going to get married, they used to pass around this shemen, whether they had people put it in the hair of the Rabbanan, or it was passed around in the Rabbanan and put it in their hair, but it was a celebratory type of oil that was only used when there was a kala bitula. Now the Gemara asks, Amrlata b'may. When it comes to an almanah that's getting married, what is the siman of an almanah that is getting married? Tosafot over here claims that this is Bihuda boy, that they're asking in Yehuda, what is the siman? You could argue that the Gemara is asking here in Bavel, what is the siman? Tani Rav Yosef Amrlata leit la kisne. When it comes to an almanah, they do not have kisne at her wedding. As Tosafot points out, they would not hand out these roasted kernels at the chuppah of an almana in order to indicate clearly that this was a marriage of an almana, not a marriage of a bitula. That's according to Tosafot. Others say the kisne is some sort of wheat kernel that was roasted, or wheat and beans together that were cooked. And they have an alternate girsa in the Gemara, which is Armalata itla kisne, that the Armalata, they have these kisne, and it's explained this way, which is kisne is something that is cooked, something that is roasted. So at the weddings of an almanah, they used to hand those out, whereas at the weddings of a bitula, they used to hand out the raw kisne. They would keep it raw in order to distinguish between them. The bitula, who's still quote-unquote uncooked, she has the raw item that's handed out. On the other hand, the almanah, who is quote-unquote cooked, she has the items that were roasted or cooked, and that was a way to signify the difference between them. That girsa may make a little more sense, because it's easier to do something actively to indicate that someone's an almanah versus a betula, rather than to talk about the absence of an item at a chuppah to designate this woman as an almanah. So Akaris Tosafot is explaining it according to the girsa that we have. But if you have this alternate girsa, it might be easier to understand that they had this practice with the amanot, and this practice with the bitulot, which distinguished because of the nature of the item that was handed out between bitulot and amanot. Umode Rabbi Yeshua Bomer L'Chaveiro. Now we're down to the second half of the Mishnah. We say in the second half of the Mishnah, in the case with the field, the Rabbi Yeshua agrees over there that we believe the individual because of Hapesh Asur, Hapesh Hitir, because he's the one who admits that the field belonged to this individual's father. And therefore, when he tells us he bought it from him, we believe him. Because a pesha asur, pesha hitir, the Rishonim argue about what the nature of that is. Is that a migo? And therefore, it's just a type of migo? Or is its own independent type of claim, which is pesha asur, pesha hitir, works differently than migo? And of course, there are implications, because migo doesn't work in certain instances. And maybe we would invoke pesha asur, pesha hitir, even in cases where migo might not work. So that depends on how you view this type of claim. Remember again that Rashi believes in the Mishnah that these are cases where the other party is not making any claim against them. He's volunteering the information completely. Tosafot, on the other hand, believes it's even in a case where the other party is making a demand on him and being toveya him. Nevertheless, since he has the ability to make a better claim, which to say, lo yu dvarim meolam, he can make a claim here that, yes, you're right, your father owned it, and I bought it. So that is the difference between them, and then I will play out a little bit in the Gemara here. Mar says, v'litnei moder Rabbi Yeshua v'omer l'chaveiro, why doesn't the Mishnah write it this way? Why doesn't it say Rabbi Yeshua agrees in a case where he says to his friend, that this was your field, and I purchased it from you? So why does the Mishnah use the father as the example over here, when an individual speaking to the father and says, speaking to the son, saying that I bought this property from your father, why don't we have him speaking to the individual himself and says, this was your property, and I purchased it from you? Now, it's an interesting question of the Gemara, because the scenario brought to Mishnah is much more likely than the scenario mentioned here in the Gemara. But, as Rashi points out, if the whole problem here is the lack of tviyah, the lack of a claimant, that's what Rashi thinks is going on in the Mishnah, then what does it matter if there was no claim made by the father, or by the son on behalf of the father, versus the son making a claim on behalf of himself? So therefore we should be indifferent between these two scenarios. And again, according to the Tosafot, who believes that we could have a claimant here, the only question here is, if the whole point is that he's believed because he could just say, lo hayu dvarim me'olam, the fact that he now volunteers this information saying that it was your field, I agree, but I purchased it, then why is it any different than if he's speaking about the father? So the Gemara wants to know, why is the Mishnah written about a son being spoken to or dealing with the issues of his father rather than dealing with his own issues? Gemara says, Mishom, the Kabai Limitna Seifa, because we need the latter half, the Mishnah says, Im Yeshi Dim Shishalo, if there are witnesses that there is his, V'omer L'Kachtiha Mimeno, and he says, I purchased it from him, Eino Ne'eman, he's not believed. The Gemara wants to know, Eifidami, what's the case there? Ida Achla Shnei Chazaka, if he ate it the years of Chazaka, Amai Lo Mehemen, why is he not believed? Now, Chazaka is a concept that shows up in Shas in two different ways. Chazaka in the Gemara in Kiddushin and the Mishnayot in Kiddushin is a methodology of Kinyan. It's a way to acquire real property, which is Kesef, Shtar, and Chazaka. That's when a person takes hold of the property, exercises authority and ownership over the property by doing something to the property. That's not the Chazaka that we're speaking about here. There's another Chazaka that appears in the Gemara in Mishnayot in Baba Batra. And there, Chazaka is basically the equivalent of what we call squatter's rights, or the ability to create an easement, which is that if a person utilizes an area for a certain amount of time, the underlying assumption is that he must be the owner of this land, otherwise someone would not let him stay there without being stopped or without saying something about the way that he's exercising this type of ownership over the land. The Gemara over there says that the amount is 3 years. 3 years in order to establish a chazaka. Now the reason for that is because the documentation of the person's ownership of the property, he would have to maintain that. That's a shtar. They didn't have a central bureau where they could file this, so they kept all this information. And therefore, it was difficult to keep and store a shtar for long periods of time. So what the Chachamim said is that for the first 3 years, a person has to make sure they have the shtar, because if anybody comes and makes a counterclaim to his ownership, he can show them the document. After 3 years, we don't have an expectation that the individual will keep the shtar anymore. And the fact that he's been there is enough evidence of the fact that he does own it. The Gemara in Baba Batra is very clear that he has to have a taina. He has to be a claim. Just living there for 3 years is not a claim on the property. It's different than the rules, like in England and other places where they have squatter's rights, that if you live there for a duration of time, you create an easement, and therefore you own the property, or you can stay there without any claim. You don't even have to say it's yours, it's just because you live there. That's not true here. The person has to have a claim of some sort, which is that I purchased it, I bought it, or how it came into his possession. Once he makes that claim, then the chazaka can bolster that claim. And that's what is being asked about over here, this chazaka. How did he establish ownership? So if he achla shnei chazaka, if he utilized the field for the requisite 3 years, which means either he worked the fields or he took from the fruits of the field for 3 years, my lo mehemen, why isn't he believed? Even if Edim come along and say that it belonged to this individual, then what's the difference if it belonged to him, because this guy says, I bought it from you, and now I've been there for 3 years. Bidol achla shnei chazaka, if he has yet to be there for the requisite 3 years, pshita delo mehemen. It's very clear that he shouldn't be believed over here, because he doesn't have a shtar, he doesn't have shnei chazaka to bolster his position that he bought it, so then why is it helping? So the Gemara says here, in the latter half of the Mishnah, If we're talking about the individual themselves and not the father, then what is going on here with the Edim? Either there is something that bolsters his claim that he belongs there, the Chazakah, and the Edim don't matter. Or he doesn't have that to back him up, and then the Edim shut him down, and you don't need the Mishnah to tell you that information. So Gemara says, Yehochi Gabi Aviv Nami. So even if you change the case to be a case where it's his father's property, why does that change the dynamic? You have the same question. Idach lo shnei chazakah amaylo mehemen. If he's there for the requisite years to establish a chazakah or ownership over this property, why isn't he believed? Vili lo idach lo shnei chazakah pshita lo mehemen. You can say the same thing over there. If he wasn't there the requisite number of years, he shouldn't be believed. Where it says, no, bishlomo gabi aviv mishkachala. By the father, we can find it in a case. He was there for 2 years while the father was alive. And one of the years, to make the total of 3 years, was done after the passing of the father, when the son was aware of him being there. So does that establish a chazakah or not? Ukid Rav Huna, and this is similar to Rav Huna, Dam Rav Huna, Ein machzikim b'nechzei katan, afilu igdil. One may not make a chazakah on the properties of a katan, even after he grows up. So over here, there is a machloket rishonim as to what exactly this means, but the approach of most of the rishonim is that when the child is a youngster or a minor, then the fact that he did not object over here is because he's a katan. He's not aware of the dealings. He's not aware that someone is in the property of his father, and therefore his lack of speaking up or his lack of rejection of the ownership of the other individual is not because it belongs to that individual. It's because he doesn't have the ability, or he's not aware enough to make that claim. So now, that is one thing that he says. And Tavash, he says, Vafil Shigdil, even after he grows up afterwards, and this individual continues to eat in front of him, it's not considered a chazakah, Hovitz Chilato Shu Katan, because it started out when he was a katan, and therefore when he saw the starting point be when he was a katan, even when he grows up, he doesn't think to reject the ownership of this individual because as far as in his eyes is concerned, this person always owned the property. He's not aware that he should be rejecting the ownership over here. So since the beginning of this ownership happened when he was a minor, even if he grows up later and comes of age, his lack of rejection of this person's ownership is not because this person really owns it. It's because this individual does not have the requisite knowledge to make a rejection, because as far as he's concerned, his whole life, he's seen this individual be there. So he has no reason or knowledge to really reject this individual's ownership or question his ownership over here. That's the approach of Rashi and many of the Rishonim. The Rambam, on the other hand, says that this is only true while he's a minor. As long as he's a minor, we don't expect of him to reject the ownership of an adult. But once he comes of age, then we do have that expectation. And therefore, when he grows up and gets older, then we expect him to stand up and say something or make a mechah. And again, it's not enough that the person was there when he was a katan, that as soon as he becomes a gadol, he has to reject it. No, you have to establish those 3 year years of ownership once he's become a gadol. And the years before do not count. That's the way the Rambam reads the Gemara. On the other hand, there's an interesting shita Tosva quotes here from the Rashbam that says that even if he's a gadol while his father is alive, he's considered to be a katan. Because anybody vis-a-vis the business of their father or the dealings of their father, even when they are of age, is considered to be a katan. And therefore, until the father passes away, one cannot establish a chazakah, because this individual, in a sense, is subsumed under his father's dealings. He doesn't question, he doesn't ask anything about them. And therefore, he feels like if his father didn't say anything, he's not supposed to say anything, and therefore does not establish a chazakah, because his lack of rejection of the ownership of this individual is not because he really believes that this individual owns it. It's only because he saw what his father was doing, and therefore he doesn't know any better to reject it at this point in time. And therefore, according to the Rashbam, how can you ever establish a chazakah in front of a child? And that the Rabbeinu Tam, his brother, answers on his behalf and says that that's only in a case where the individual was already of age at the time that the chazakah began. And therefore, you cannot be mitzareif any period of time that was when the field was under the auspices of the father. And also has to start in a case where the individual was of age and independent enough in order to establish a chazakah, meaning that he was independent of the father already at the time of the beginning of the chazakah, that one could only establish those years of chazakah if the tchilat chazakah started when this individual was already an independent person. Now the Gemara asks the question, Virav Huna Matnitan Atale Ashminan? If that is what comes out of our Mishnah, then what? We need Rav Huna to tell us a Mishnah. If our Mishnah is giving us information, then Rav Huna is just telling us something that's already found in the Mishnah. And why is that necessary? Now, as Tosafot points out over here, this is a little interesting, because Rav Huna himself never, in a sense, said this statement. The Gemara in Baba Metzia talks about the issue of whether we are machnis krovim. We allow relatives to go down and deal with the property of a katan. And then, over there, Rav Huna says that we do allow them to go down. And Rava concludes from that, Rav Huna must believe that you cannot establish a chazaka by taking hold of the property of a katan. Because otherwise we wouldn't allow the relatives to go into the property, because then they would establish a chazaka and claim the property and say it doesn't belong to this katan. So by the mere fact that we let them go down, Rava infers from Rav Huna that that must be the position of Rav Huna. That ain't makzigim nixay katan. So Rav Huna himself never actually said it explicitly. So the Gemara's question really is, why do we need to learn this out of Rav Huna's statement in the Gemara in Baba Metzia if it's already explicit in our Mishnah? So the Gemara says either, Ibai Deima Rav Huna Diyuka Dematnitan Kamar. Rav Huna is explaining how we get this out of our Mishnah. He's explaining why the case in the Mishnah deals with a father instead of a son, in order that we come to this conclusion, which is, Ein Makzigim Nichsei B'Katan Afil Shigdil. And he's able to show that the Mishnah teaches that this information, it's not obvious out of the Mishnah. Some say that, yes, from our Mishnah, you would be able to learn out that you can't make a chazakah on the nifsei of a katan, or the nechasim of a katan, but the additional piece, afilu kishigdil, that was the addition of Rav Huna that you wouldn't get out of the Mishnah, and that's why Rav Huna came to say it. Mar says, velitnei bididei. Now, going back to the original question, why don't we establish the Mishnah, make the case in the Mishnah where it's talking about him and not his father? Velukma, and make the case like this. Kegon she'afla shtayim bifanav, v'achat shelo bifanav. Instance where he ate 2 years in front of him, meaning he established a chazaka for 2 years while the owner was present. And then, achat shelo bifanav, but then he goes away, and the final year is done when the owner is not present. Ukegon she'barach, where he ran away, he had to leave suddenly. There was pressure from the government on him, and they had to leave town. So his lack of rejecting the ownership of this individual is not because necessarily the individual owns the land. It's because he's not present, and he's unable to make that rejection or that mecha'ah. So the Gemara says, Barach Machmat Mai. Why did he run away? Ida Barach Machmat Nafashot. If he ran away because the government was after him for a capital offense, or they wanted to put him to death, Pshita Delo Mehemen. It's clear that the person who's establishing a chazakah cannot be believed over here, or cannot establish a chazakah, delo matzimachi, because the individual can't reject it, he can't disclose his location, he can't send messages back for fear of being caught by the government. Vida barach machmat mamon, if he ran away because of monetary matters, he was trying to escape creditors, or he was trying to escape monetary pressures, ibay le'lim chuyeh. In that instance, he should be able to reject it because he sent word back and he can send a message saying that that land belongs to me, or that this person shouldn't be in there because, again, he's not hiding for his life. He's trying to get out of the monetary pressures, and there he can send messages back because his location isn't as important as him just not being in the present locale. The Kaimalon, Micha'a shlo bifanav, havya Micha'a. If a person rejects the ownership of an individual, even if it's not done in front of him, he doesn't have to come to the field. He doesn't have to come to the person who's supposedly living in the field and say, it's not yours, it's mine. He can just, anywhere he is, say to Edim, it is my field and he does not belong there. And as Tosafot points out over here, Tema, Amay nakat b'chol duchta mecha'a shelo b'fanav, havelei d'minkat chazaka shelo b'fanav. Why everywhere the Gemara says this, it says that when one rejects it, when I'm not in front or present in front of the property that is being held here, that we say that mecha, that rejection is good. Why don't we just say the chazakah? If one establishes a chazakah, even though the owner is not present, that chazakah is a good chazakah. And so Tosafot explains here, b'yish lomar, the igar atam talui b'mecha. The reason why a person establishes a chazakah is because there's no rejection of their ownership. The chazakah vada yish lakol, afilu shelo b'fanav. The chazakah, everybody hears about a person taking ownership over land, working the land, and that spreads. And the Gemara in Baba Batra talks about the fact that the 3 years is exactly for that reason. 1 year for the news to travel from wherever they are to the edge of the western edge of civilization to Spain. Then for the person to get the information, be moche, and then for the traveler to return back in that period of time to tell them that he rejected the ownership. So the 3 years is all about the ability of the owner to hear about it and reject it. The lack of rejection is what establishes the chazakah. It's not the actual chazakah that is established by living there. The living there is only a chazakah because nobody rejected it. Nobody did a mecha'ah. And therefore, the Gemara's focus is always on the rejection side of it. And therefore, if you do a mecha'ah, shelo b'fanav, not in front of the person that is trying to establish a chazakah, that is a good enough mecha'ah. And this person should have done that. The fact that he didn't do it means that he lost his rights here. The Tanan, shlosh aratzot l'chazakah. We have three distinct regions when it comes to chazakah. In Eretz Yisrael, Yehuda, Eivar Yardain, v'Galil. This appears in many Mishnayot and Shas. It deals with Shvi'it and other areas where these regions were considered to be distinct from each other. Hayab Yehuda, v'chzik v'Galil. If the individual was in Yehuda, and there was a chazakah being established in the Galil, v'Galil, v'chzik v'Yehuda, he was in the Galil, and they'd made a chazakah on the property in Yehuda, eino chazakah, it's only a chazakah if he's in the same region as this individual. And we question about that Mishnah. Micah Savar. What do they believe there? If you believe that a rejection that is not done in the presence of an individual then is a good rejection, then why should it make a difference if one of the parties in Yehuda and one of the parties is in Galil? As long as locally, wherever he is, he says, that's my property, that should be sufficient. And if he really believes that when the rejection is not done in the front of the person trying to establish the chazakah, that it's not considered to be a good mecha'ah, why should it matter that you're in distinct regions? Even within a single region, if you're not in front of the individual, it won't be considered to be a rejection of their establishing the chazakah. So why do the regions matter? So Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Mamel, Lolam Kasavar Mecha'ah Shelo B'Fanav Avi Mecha'ah, that everybody agrees here that a rejection from afar is considered to be a rejection. And therefore, he is obligated over here to reject it. Even if he's in Galil and the other party's in Yehuda. So then why does the Mishnah say that it doesn't work, the chazakah doesn't work when they're in these separate regions? Umatnitan b'shat chirum shanu. And our Mishnah is talking about a case when it was dangerous emergency situation where people were not free to travel between the regions. There was, whether it was civil war, whether the governors of those areas were very makpid, or it was treacherous to travel between them. And therefore, the news flow between those areas was not very common and not very efficient. So in that way, you can't establish a chazakah because just because you're doing this in Yehuda doesn't mean that it's automatically you get the news or the information get through Galil, and vice versa would be true as well. Therefore, establishing a chazakah when someone's not in your region does not work because we don't assume they know about it. If they don't know about it, they can't reject it. The lack of rejection without knowledge is not considered to be a chazakah, because the chazakah, as we said before, is only established by the lack of rejection when they know about it. And then that's what establishes the chazakah. So Mar says, if that's the case, then why does the Mishnah give the examples of Yehuda and Galil? As Rashi says, they could have given an example of any two cities that are don't have a free flow of information between them. What is so special about Yehuda and Galil? Others say that the question just could have been said in a more general sense. Just say two regions or two areas where you can't reach. Why does the Mishnah specifically mention Yehuda v'Galil? My answer is the Stam Yehuda v'Galil kishat chirum damu. That Stam, the default status of Yehuda and Galil, is that there is no free travel between them and that the news flow between them is very limited. And therefore, you cannot establish a chazakah if one of the owners in one of these locations and the property is in the other location. So the Mishnah is teaching you, yes, this is the din for places where there's no free flow of information. And the default of Yehuda and Galil is exactly that, where there is no free flow of information. Tosafot over here raises the issue by Gitin that we say there is movement of information over there. Tosafot differentiates between the cases because in that case, the woman is looking for Edim. She's looking for witnesses that can testify to the fact that this information is true. And if she looks for people, she might find them. By the case of the Chazakah, it's just the opposite. The person making the Chazakah on the property is not looking to make sure the information gets to the other party. And in that case, we're not going to assume that the information flows freely between Yehuda and Galil. Okay, we're going to stop over here on the first line on the top of Yudchet Amud Aleph.